Hello and welcome to Tablets Israel Update. It's been 157 days to the war. It's a Tuesday that we're recording now, 12th of March 2024. It's sunlight at the Hudson offices. Hello, Mike.
Headquarters.
Yeah, the headquarters. And my colleague Mike Duran is representing us at that august institution. And he is also the director of an august within an august institution called, Mike, you'll say,
Center for Peace and Security in the Middle East.
Because whenever I try to say it, it ends up peace and prosperity. Because I'm an Israeli, I can't connect peace and security. They don't. It's oil and water. It doesn't work.
But your intro reminds me of Churchill about a riddle wrapped in an enigma inside a conundrum. No, what I can't remember. What Russia is a riddle inside an enigma inside a mystery. So we're augustness wrapped in, I don't know. Okay, I can't find the words.
We'll figure it out by next episode. So today we things are very stormy, and ever since this program began, more or less, I think maybe on the second or even the first show, Mike, you said that in every war that Israel had, the United States set a time limit. And so we've been following this issue in many ways. I look at the titles of our almost, I think, 40 shows we have already, Mike, maybe more. And I look at the titles, and often they were some variation on, is America going to stop Israel now? Has the plan to stop the war moved into gear? But now apparently the plan is also to topple the Netanyahu government, about which we shall talk. There's also a new report on the complicity of a security personnel from the Palestinian Authority in terror attacks. And so we'll give you a little bit of the data from there and ask what it means for the fantasy of a revitalized Palestinian authority. I'll actually even quote a new book that's out on this subject. But first, Mike, over to you for the headlines.
Okay, so the biggest news, I think, comes from last Saturday night when President Biden came up with his expressed his harshest criticism of Prime Minister Netanyahu since the beginning of the war. Netanyahu, Biden said, was, quote, hurting Israel more than helping Israel. He has a right to defend Israel, but he must pay more attention to the innocent lives being lost as a consequence of the actions taken, unquote. Biden went on to express concern about the campaign, the impending campaign to take Rafah, the last stronghold of Hamas in Gaza. Biden warned that an Israeli attack on Rafah would cross a quote-unquote red line. And Biden hinted that the U.S. might withhold some types of military assistance to Israel in the event of a Rafah campaign. In response, Netanyahu told Politico that he didn't, this is a quote, didn't know exactly what the president meant. If he meant by that I was pursuing a private policy against the wish of the majority of Israelis and that this was hurting the interests of Israel, then he is wrong on both counts. In an interview with the German publication Bild, Netanyahu said that the IDF would operate in Rafah, despite Biden calling it a red line. Netanyahu said, quote, we'll go there. We're not going to leave them, meaning the hostages. You know, I have a red line. You know what that red line is? That October 7 doesn't happen again. Never happens again. And to do that, we have to complete the destruction of the Hamas terrorist arm, unquote. With regard to the negotiations between Israel and Hamas, they remain deadlocked. That was after the United States and the Arab mediators, Qatar and Egypt, tried to reach an agreement before the start of Ramadan. Ramadan Mubarak, Gadi. Mm-hmm. And the apparent sticking point in the negotiations appears to be the positions taken by Hamas, which include the complete end to the conflict, the evacuation of the Gaza Strip by the Israeli military, and an end to all of the day after discussions that are going on. On another issue, Hezbollah fired about 100 rockets this morning, that's Tuesday morning, in two barrages at the Golan Heights. Those are two barrages in less than 1 hour. Some of the rockets were intercepted and others fell in uninhabited areas. There were no reports of injuries or damages. Air raid sirens sounded in several Golan communities and in the Upper Galilee. Hezbollah unleashed the barrages in retaliation for an Israeli Air Force strike last night in Baalbek, deep inside Lebanon. Yesterday, that's on Monday, a gag order was lifted on a reporting of an Israeli Air Force strike in the central Gaza Strip on Saturday. The reported target of that strike was Marwan Issa. He's basically the number three in the military wing of Hamas, subordinate only to Yahya Sinwar and Mohammed Deif. IDF spokesperson Daniel Hagari said yesterday that the IDF was, quote, still studying the results of the attack and there is still no final confirmation of Issa's death. Finally, Gadi, Almog Cohen, a member of Knesset from the far-right Otzma Yehudit party, that's the Jewish power party, has appealed to the Israeli Supreme Court to lift another gag order, this one pertaining to the name of an IDF officer who is up on charges of espionage. This case is getting attention, as I'm sure you know, in the Israeli right-wing infosphere, but not in the mainstream media. Due to the gag order on the details of the case, it's not entirely clear to me what is going on here. I see tweets saying that the Israeli spy passed classified information to civilians and in so doing supposedly delayed the ground maneuver in Gaza by 2 weeks. I also see other social media posts calling the gag order a cover-up, suggesting that the spy episode is somehow connected to the controversy surrounding the judicial reform. But I really don't understand what's going on. Gadi, I turn to you to explain to me what this is about and whether it's really worth our time to even discuss it.
Yeah, I think it's definitely worth our time. And what makes it worth our time is their insistence on the gag order. Not only are they insisting on a gag order after this was exposed by a member of Knesset, Almog Cohen, after he began digging into this, suddenly he got what we call a prosecution knock on roof. Suddenly they said there was a case against him from 11 years ago for aggression against a prisoner or something, a prisoner of war.
A case against Almog Cohen.
Yeah, 11 years ago that they were going to open. That's almost an open threat. And as we know, the attorney general in Israel is extremely political. Many people believe that there is a strong connection between the attempts of Almog Cohen to use his chasinut, his
immunity
as a member of Knesset, and they hinted that trouble can befall him. There are also some heartbreaking scenes. He also carries war trauma himself, and was involved in the defense as a citizen on October 7. And so the whole thing was very emotional. But people tended to connect this to the attempt at mutiny that accompanied the struggle over the reform, you know, the refuseniks, the threats by Ehud Barak and people around him for civil disobedience and maybe a general strike and other things. And so people began to connect or attempt to connect or invent conspiracy theories in which this was a spy of the far left inside the IDF, because the guy just waltzed into the central command of the Gaza Brigade without being even recruited and documented stuff there. And so without a conspiracy theory, we are at loss to explain why an Israeli would do this. And what makes it so suspicious is not just that it's not just, you know, a crackpot, is the fact.
So hold on. I'm having trouble following the story. A guy goes in the all of the confusion after October 7th. He walks into Central Command.
Yeah, I think the central command of the Gaza division.
And he starts collecting information.
Yeah, he's an officer. He is a reserve officer, but he was not recruited, and that's not his job. So he came into these places, and people started saying, nobody knew who he was, but they say, oh, he's okay. He's an officer from here, there. He said, you know, a number of a unit that can happen in the IDF. You know, when I was a young reservist, my friend and I wanted to go skiing in the Hermon, and we went hitchhiking because we want to get very early to the mountain, you know. And we slept at some army base because we had our uniforms, and we just said we are from Central Command and we just need to bunk in for the night. And so they said, oh yeah, shh. And they gave us a room and two mattresses. And the next day at 5 o'clock, we were off to skiing in the Hermon. But Israel, you know, everything is unofficial. Everybody knows everybody. So probably what happened is everyone assumed that he's okay because someone else thought he was okay. And we don't know. And the thing is, I'm not saying that any of the conspiracy theories are right. I'm just saying that there must be something there because they are so insistent on this gag order. And today, Almog Cohen appealed to the Supreme Court about it. He's willing to take this fight and he knows something. And he also, you probably saw his tweets saying, I'm going to fight this fight to the end because it's important. So apparently.
So all the stuff I'm seeing on social media is just, it may be a lot of hooey. We don't really know. There's just, we know that a guy walked into the division headquarters, took information, disseminated it to people who shouldn't have been there, didn't have the right to have this information, and disseminated it to other people who had no reason to be involved to have the information.
Yeah, and that either
mishandled classified information. But what's all the business about delayed the ground maneuver for 2 weeks? Where's that coming from?
I have no explanation.
Okay. Yeah.
I can just say it connects to the theory that somehow this is a anti-government left-wing conspiracy, and these people are also suspected as cooperating with the American administration behind.
Okay. So it goes on from there, Mike.
It goes on from there. Be careful. It goes all the way to the Soviet Union. No, I'm kidding.
You remember there was that spy that next to Ben Gurion, who was a Soviet spy, the guy close to. But anyway, we're putting a halt to all this. Then we don't know anything. There's a member of Knesset who thinks that there's something big here, but we don't know what it is, and we're waiting to find out. Okay, all right. Interesting.
So Biden and Netanyahu, for the first time, this is an attempt to actually cooperate with the opposition, almost overtly, to remove an elected government in Israel, isn't it?
Well, we've got, you know, from the beginning, I didn't believe, just as you have been reminding us all along, that the conflict between the elite and Netanyahu is going, despite all of the desire for unity in the Israeli public, there's still a kind of October 6th mentality about Netanyahu among the elite in Israel. I also have felt two things. One, that the hostility of the Biden administration to Netanyahu was still at work, even during the war. But more importantly, that as importantly, I would say, that the desire to arrive at a strategic accommodation with Iran is still shaping America's policy. It's not apparent to a lot of people because Hamas is a proxy of Iran, and the Biden administration has given Israel the support it needs so far in order to defeat Hamas. But I think we're coming up against the limits of that support now. And I've expected this all along, as you mentioned, and I think now everybody can see it. So the good news here is that the strategic picture has clarified. I think the bad news is there is this clash between Washington and Netanyahu. You've brought up in the past that as a strategy for toppling Netanyahu, this is not a very good one, because when Netanyahu says, as I mentioned today in the headlines, that he is representing the mainstream view, the view of the majority of Israelis. So regardless of how they feel about him personally, they want the war to continue, and he's got the Israeli public behind him. And Gantz knows that. Gantz, who would be the alternative to Netanyahu that the Americans would like to see in power, the Americans can't orchestrate a crisis to install Gantz, because Gantz also realizes that the Israeli public wants this to continue. So there are Americans are actually pushing Gantz and Netanyahu together. That's your analysis. What I think is there's another irony here, or paradox, which is that the administration says it has two goals. One goal is to defeat Hamas, and the other goal is to shorten the war and bring about a quick end to this. I guess they don't say they necessarily want that, but you can tell they want to go into the election. They want the war over by summertime, so they can go to the election with a quiet Middle East, saying that they supported Israel and quieted everything down. But their policy as a whatever we think of it as an electoral policy, as a rhetoric for appealing to American voters, and I don't know that I'm well qualified to decide how good it is, but that clearly is one of their goals. They want to appeal to the progressive voters by attacking Netanyahu. As a strategy, they're going to have the opposite effect, because they are prolonging the war. When they come out openly hostile to Netanyahu, they encourage Hamas to take more extreme positions, because Hamas thinks the longer it holds out, the more pressure America will put on Netanyahu and give the Hamas the concessions that it wants. Paradoxically, in order to get Hamas to cut a deal that could actually lead to a ceasefire, the United States needs to show Israel more support, so that Hamas realizes that if it continues to negotiate in bad faith or to put forth proposals that are really non-starters for everyone, then they're going to have to pay a price from the United States. They're not. The administration isn't doing that. Also, I mean, if they prolong the war in this way, the Americans, then they're increasing the likelihood that they're going to have a continued civilian deaths and images of destruction from Gaza at the top of the headlines as they go to the polls in November. So, as a strategy for actually achieving what they say they want to achieve, they're not doing very well, I don't think. But as a rhetorical strategy for saying to their progressive voters that they have the right values, the virtue signaling that they're engaged in, they're perhaps being successful. I don't know how to judge it.
What I think they rely on is they still think that Gantz represents a viable alternative moderate option in the eyes of a substantial block of voters. And this block of voters supposedly supports the two-state solution. Now, the press trumpets that, because the press belongs to the tiny progressive minority, which still wants to resurrect the two-state solution. But the two-state solution is absolutely dead in the eyes of the Israeli public. And so the whole calculation is wrong, because the calculation is let's get Gantz closer to us in Washington and support the idea behind a two-state solution, and then say Netanyahu is this extremist. We have the war because of Netanyahu, right? That's the way a Sullivan or a Blinken would probably analyze the situation. While what is happening in Israel, and I can't say I don't have any polls. I only have intuition, and I've lost the ability to understand very subtly how much of the press propaganda is the left side of the electorate buying. There's always a danger that even blatant lies will be bought. But many Israelis look at this and say, Gantz is going to Washington behind the prime minister of the cabinet in which he is serving and against the will of the prime minister, and is behaving like he is a lackey of the White House and not a representative of his voters. And so if this, imagine he can get some Likudniks out of the Likud to vote for another kind of coalition, and there's an opportunity to change the structure. Theoretically, that's what he should do. But if he goes to Washington, and if he presents himself as undermining the cabinet that's engaged in the war effort, he will actually lose traction. So even if there's a theoretical calculation in which he could form an alternative coalition, his chances by acting the way he acts are worse. And also look at the big picture. The big picture is Gantz went to Washington, and 2 days after that, Biden puts his foot down and says, there's a red line and you can't go to Rafah. And people are saying, was Gantz successful in his mission? Well, maybe if the mission was to topple Netanyahu, he achieved something. But if the mission was to preserve the interests of Israel, well, clearly that was a failure, because look what we got.
Are you hearing people actually saying that? I mean, other than on Channel 14, are you people who have just sort of, who aren't excessively political and are middle of the road? Are you hearing them asking questions like that, or no?
No, these are all hypotheses. Part of the price of us not, I mean, you see it in the right, in the right wing press, which is center and right wing press. But there's no real rapport between the sides. It's awful.
And so, same thing has happened here. I used to, because I used to be a professor, and then I was at the Brookings Institution, and just my social life and my family and everything, I used to talk to Democrats a lot more. And I used to be a Democrat. So I had a much better sense of where the of how they were absorbing things day to day. But as you know, the world we're in now, you only talk to people who think like you. It's very dangerous. Yeah. I'm not the first person to say that, of course. We all know that.
I am trying to see and analyze and understand what they're saying. I, as you know, in one of our last episodes, I had footage from there, so I got stuck into one of their demonstrations.
That was funny.
And that does give some insight. And I read their tweets, and I think that I can come up with an understanding, not for now, but an attempt to explain some of the what I see as contradictions in the left's discourse. What you see in the media is that a lot of the left has just become the PR personnel of the White House. They're all repeating it. By the way, Gantz did too. And so now they're saying their new thing is Hamas betrayed the true values of Islam.
I always laugh when Americans who are basically Christians or post-Christians, let's say secular Christians, from a Christian background but are secular, and they talk in the name of other religions. I find it really amusing. It's an American conceit, that we're all the same. Yeah. We all want the same things for our children. We all have the same values. It's actually a Protestant modernist view. Underneath all of the religions is basically all the same values. Those Aztecs who carried out child sacrifices. You know, they really wanted the same thing for their children that we want. But
that's a great.
I don't say this as a criticism of Islam. I find it funny that like you don't even believe your own religion. Why are you telling me what other religions believe?
Yeah, and Gantz repeated the exact same line, and I read it from Nadav Eyal at Yediot Ahronot today, and it was along with another line. We'll talk about this in a minute. The other line was that Hamas is trying to derail the peace process. What?
it's like a time bubble from
Oslo, from the exploding buses. And I'll tell you in a minute why this connects to our last subject of discussion today. I just wanted to tell you that if you want an analysis of the religious elements in the October 7 attack, you are welcome to our in-depth special entitled Hamas Theology and Ideology. I'll put a link to it in the description of this video, with Eliezer Sherki, who worked in the Sharia department of the Israel State Attorney and offers a very illuminating analysis. So the next topic has to do with the fact that people are bringing back the old Oslo arguments. And the old Oslo arguments said that all these exploding buses were the enemies of peace, and us moderates, we have to stick together, and because we all have radicals.
I believed all that.
I did too. It was very convincing at the time. And where is the black hole in that description? We assume, you know, we have a majority for peace, and then there are a few radicals.
On either side. I always thought there's about 20% on either side, and they work off each other. They feed off each other with violence against the moderate middle.
What's the hole in this argument? Is that we know what the 80% who are moderates on our side is, but where are the 80% moderates on the Palestinian side? Where is Palestinian peace now? Where are all those peace-loving Palestinians who are derailed by their radicals? But the whole Oslo framework relied on one simple idea.
By the way, you and I disagree about where the hole is, but we don't need to go into it now. I just want to flag it. Whenever it comes up, I always like to...
Okay, just tell us what it is that you're flagging and what the alternative is.
I don't think that Palestinian ruling institutions are responsive to public opinion. It's an irrelevant question.
Yeah,
I don't think the Syrian or the Lebanese institutions are responsible to. There's a little bit more responsiveness in some places than others. So Jordan, Jordan is a good one, but the monarchies in the Gulf are more responsive, I think. But Iraq, Lebanon.
But Mike, this just moves the argument to another arena. While what I can answer now, and we won't get into the question of how responsive they are to public opinion, there are also no institutions that are moderate and are in favor of peace. And everyone thought the Palestinian Authority, even before it was revitalized, is not really heading for peace. And here lies the center of the Oslo worldview. Because what is the heart of Oslo? If you strip all the rhetoric and just look at what are the cold calculations of pragmatic arrangements. And the core of Oslo is outsourcing security. We assume that there is a moderate Palestinian authority that is striving for a Palestinian state and an end to the conflict in a partition deal of two states. And so we will give them guns so they can suppress the radical Hamas, which is carrying out the attacks. And this turned out to be a false premise, and this is why Oslo collapsed. But
this
now,
is where I, just a little, again, we don't have to, it doesn't have to be a big debate, but a little difference of opinion between us. For me, why there can't be a two-state solution is very simple, very, very simple. The guy who is ruling in Ramallah doesn't have control over the West Bank, let alone Gaza. The guy who's ruling in Ramallah, you can cut a deal with him. He can't guarantee what's going to happen from a security point of view in Gaza. He cannot. And it is not in Israel's ability to make him capable of that. There's an assumption somewhere in that when we're going to have a revitalized, revamped, strengthened, reformed Palestinian Authority, and it's going to take power. And it's in it's in the power of the United States and Israel to wave their magic wand and turn Abu Mazen into the guy who can actually control the Gaza Strip. I don't believe that for a second. It's just not. It's false. It's false. Yeah. It's not true.
But what may be hiding behind it, Mike, is the idea that behind the Fatah, what actually gives it power is IDF bayonets, and this has been the actual arrangement for a long, long time.
Yes.
For a long time.
Yes, but that power is even with the backing of the IDF, the power is limited.
Very limited. There is a lot of influence to what the general public supports there, and it supports Hamas. And it not just supports Hamas theoretically, it actually nurtures and helps it build its power and gives it its recruits. So Hamas is a stronger power. Support for Hamas is greater than for the corrupt Palestinian Authority. And the reason that the Palestinian Authority stays in power is it can't afford to suppress Hamas because Hamas is popular. And so it outsources the suppression of Hamas to the IDF. So you have two layers of outsourcing. But the first layer was supposed to be that the Palestinian Authority has been given guns, it has been given training by the American military in order to stop terrorism. And it never did that. So now fast forward to the present, where again the Israeli press, along with the State Department, the White House, and some of Israel's left-wing politicians, and some of its, importantly, some of its higher brass in the military and the security apparatus, are all trying to bring back the two-state solution. And so Nadav Argaman, who was the head of Shabak, who, by the way, supported refusal in the reform struggle, said in the Israel, he said it at INSS. He said, the Palestinian Authority does not support terror. So he's trying to resurrect. This is funny for Israelis because 7% of the budget of the Palestinian Authority is a pay-for-slay program. They guarantee the income of anyone who would kill Jews or the families or their families, if they're killed as shaheeds, as martyrs, or if they sit in prisons in Israel so long that they're in prison. This is why one of the terrorists in one of the early exchange deals refused to go out of prison, because that would mean...
Because you can make more money at home.
Yeah, his family would go bankrupt. It's a 19-year-old guy. And Israel nevertheless kicked him back to Gaza, because these were the terms of the deal. So 7% of that budget goes to the pay for slay. And it doesn't matter how many cuts they receive on international aids. Mahmoud Abbas himself said, if we are only left with a handful of cents, we would still pay them to the holy shaheeds, to the martyrs and to the families of the prisoners who are, he says, and I'm quoting, the stars in the Palestinian sky. So this is the Palestinian Authority that finances, incentivizes, and puts its prestige behind terrorism as the highest calling of the Palestinian people. Streets, schools, even sports events are called almost exclusively on the names of dead terrorists who died carrying out terror against Jews. So Nadav Argaman, apparently he was the head of Shabak, but he never heard of these things. And what is worse is, you know, now there are two NGOs who produced reports about how many active security forces personnel of the Palestinian Authority carry out terror attacks against Jews. Now, this is hard to follow because the Israeli press, if you see a report about a terrorist and there's no organizational affiliation, that's because he belongs to the Fatah and the security apparatus, and they're trying to hide this.
That's very interesting.
They,
so we have two new reports. I haven't heard about these.
Yeah, one report is not that new. I interviewed the head of the Palestinian Media Watch, which I recommend to everybody to follow because they do much more than just...
What is his or her name?
Itamar Marcus is the head of the Palestinian Media Watch, and we'll put a link to that report too. That report is called Terrorists in Uniform. And what I can, I opened all these files and I'm not sure which is which. So we can start with Regavim. This is the new report. It's today I saw the PDF of the English version, which will be out in a few days. These are galleys for proofreading.
Oh.
And it will be ready. The Hebrew has been published by Moranti. You remember we quoted.
Oh, this. No, I know about this. This is what's the price of a Jewish, dead Jew.
No? That's a book by Lital Shemesh.
Oh, Moran is the, she has the Twitter feed that she's really good.
She put together this report. And instead of trying to follow the very hard to, because the IDF also hides this information from the public, because, you know, the IDF is also on the side of the two-state solution. I mean, the high brass are.
When I was a student in Israel, I knew this guy, I won't say his name. I knew this guy who was from a Sephardic family from the Middle East. Actually, 12 generations in Jerusalem, actually.
Oh.
But he grew up speaking Arabic. And if you saw him speaking Arabic, you'd have thought he was an Arab. He had the most hard right political opinions. I would say racist. I don't need to put too fine a point on it. He was pretty racist against Arabs. But he watched the Friday afternoon movie. You know, it used to be the Arab movie.
Yeah, sure.
He listened to Arabic music. And if you got him on the subject of Arab culture, in the movies, he would say he only watched the Arab movies. And he said, he'd always say to me, Mike, if you want to understand feeling, if you want to understand feeling, you have to watch the Arab media. We don't understand feeling. There was such a funny duality in his personality, because in everything cultural and emotional, he was Arab, but politically he was very, very hard right.
But you know, there's a way to reconcile these things, and some of these people actually say that. They say, we love Arab culture and we know it deeply. That is why we know you can't live with this. You can't live with these people. They'll never accept you. They only want to kill you. We know.
Yeah, he may say that, but he also, I don't know. It was just, it doesn't matter. It's just kind of interesting to see those things.
So I chose two quotes for you, and the reason I chose them was not.
He used to cry. He used to watch the Arab movies on Friday afternoon and cry.
It was an event. There were no movies on the television back then. And so some, and not in my house, but my neighbor, the whole family, aunts, uncles would all gather to watch the Arab movie on Friday evening. There was no VOD. There was no channel. You could only go to the cinema, and then there was this one film a week. And an Arab cinema, I remember it because I remember it visually, it had this sentimental in your face quality, you know, suddenly quick zooms into the angry face of the brother who just saw his sister let her hair down. And it's like it was ultra dramatic. And a lot of people were moved. So the two quotes.
Okay, sorry. I remember Shimon Peres. Everyone in Israel was ridiculing him because he was trying to look like he was, one of the common people.
Yeah.
And they asked him, you know, what do you like to do to relax? And he said he watched the Arab movie on the Arabic movie on Friday afternoon.
Sure.
Nobody believed him. I'm sure it was not true.
So I chose two quotes for you. I'm not going to be able to read them today, probably, but I'll try. And they are not. And I chose them not because they are reliable, but because they are indicative. They are indicative of what? They are indicative of Fatah and and security Palestinian Authority personnel trying to brag about their participation in terror in the competition with Hamas.
Uh-huh.
So you have a spokesman for the Palestinian Authority, yet to be revitalized, that said that in the three decades since Oslo, almost 400 people of the Palestinian security apparatus are prisoners in Israel. And there are over 2,000 martyrs from the security forces of the Palestinian people. So he's showing off that the Palestinian Authority is not lagging that far behind in the competition of killing Jews for the Holy
Cause. But the Israeli media is lagging behind in reporting this. If his numbers are correct.
It's lagging like 30 years behind.
Are his numbers correct?
The numbers? I looked at them against the report. I looked at them against the report of Regavim, and it's very difficult to tell because there are two different.
What is Regavim? What's the word mean?
Regavim is a small. After you plow the soil, you have these little
furrows,
rows of earth that are a little over the surface, and each one of them is a regev. Yeah, regev adama.
It might be a furrow, but I think a furrow is actually furrow.
I'd say it's the solid version of what a little wave is. And as you know, Mike, Chuck Norris can swim through Earth, so he could swim through Regavim. And
Chuck Norris doesn't flush the toilet?
Because he stares.
He scares the crap out of it.
Yeah. I think I know all of them, but they keep surprising me. And so Regavim is a movement, they call themselves, and they are promoting Israel's consciousness to our losing ground against our enemies. And by losing ground, I mean losing territory. So that's
why did this organization call itself Furrow or whatever the?
Because it has to do with Earth, and it began by with the struggle with the Bedouins over control of land in the Negev Desert. Now we have such a progressive administration as opposed to government that Bedouins get land almost for free in the Negev, while if you are a Jew and you want to buy the same plot of land, you have to pay a very steep price. So there is a whole structure of incentives that disincentivizes Jews from settling anywhere in the periphery.
I see. So Regavim is
harkening
back to the days of Trumpeldor and the idea that the border will be there where the plot will be determined by the plow and all of that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's very hard to compare these bragging, the data that he brags about to anything solid, because the Regavim's report only has to do with the last 4 years, and this is about 30 years. And then Regavim has only partial information, because this was collected by Moran Tal, the same woman we're talking about, and she did it because she follows their social media. So she picks up, say, posters of the Palestinian Authority with, you know, a poster with like passport size or thumbnail size photos of all the Shahids that they're showing off. And then she picks up the names and compares this and finds them in jails and do all this. And she was able to confirm 78, both dead and prisoners. That's way short of 2,400. But then this is only for the last 3.5 years, and he's talking about 3 decades. He's probably exaggerating, but
I'm willing to assume.
You're willing to assume what?
That he's exaggerating. Yeah. The mere fact that he feels the need to compete kind of makes your point. But exactly. I do actually disagree with you. I do think there are problems with the Palestinian Authority, but it is not the same as Hamas.
It is not the same in many ways, but it is
It's I would say it's preferable to Hamas, is what I would say.
I don't know, because if they ever get smart enough to agree to a partition deal and then wait it out until they can pull a full-fledged attack, they will be more dangerous than Hamas. Hamas is obvious, and we know what it's about. And
the worst danger is the Jews fool themselves.
Well, no, probably according to American sources, the worst danger is settler violence, as you know, the non-existent, almost non-existent settler violence, which is supposed to hide exactly this. So I'll end with the other quote. And the other quote is from the report by the Palestinian Media Watch, to which Itamar Marcus referred me. He's the author of this report. And there they have a Palestinian Authority spokesman saying, more than roughly 63 to 65% of the number of martyrs in the West Bank are members of the Fatah movement, and most of them are members of the Palestinian Authority security forces or sons of members. So, same thing, the same competition. So
security forces that have been trained by the Americans, not good.
Yeah. And so we can only marvel at Nadav Argaman, who has not heard, despite being the head of the Shabak, about the Palestinian Authority implication in terrorism. But that may explain October 7, because if this is the level of the Shabak, if this is their ability, and we have other heads of Shabak, right? And we have heads of army intelligence telling us Hamas is deterred, telling us we don't need that intelligence data because we know how to calculate the interest. This is Tamir Ayman, was also head of the head of national
INSS
intelligence. He was head of INSS, but he was also the head of the IDF intelligence, which is also the director of national intelligence. So he is the one delivering the intelligence assessment to the government, and he too has been saying that Hamas is deterred.
Will you be offended if I here before the world correct your pronunciation of English?
Oh no, please do that.
You keep saying martyr.
And you should say martyr?
Martyr, yeah.
Martyr? Martyr?
Yeah. Martyr. Martyr. Yeah. Swallow that R. Swallow it.
Redrum. Yeah. Americans can't.
It's funny to me because your English is so, it's basically letter perfect, but then every now and then you come out with a word.
No. I have typical mistakes, and those that you correct, I remember, like calibrate, as opposed to calibrate, which I pronounced like the Hebrew. And so we are now at the dumbest take on the news. Shall I start?
I don't have one. I had one, but I think we decided dumbest take should be funny. Mine isn't funny, so we'll forget. Maybe I can say it very quickly.
Please do.
No, President Biden threw out this number when he was criticizing Netanyahu, and he said, we don't want another 30,000 civilians killed. Another 30,000. And in doing so, he accepted the numbers of the Palestinian Ministry of Health, whose numbers are cooked, and they don't, among other things, they don't include all of the Hamas terrorists who have been killed. They include the killed terrorists as civilians. And to have the President of the United States mindlessly repeat propaganda of Hamas, it causes me pain, Gadi, pain deep in my soul.
Yeah. I feel vindicated, though, because, on the Israeli media, I've been criticizing this administration, a lot of it based on your work in the media. And when Biden came here, everybody said, Gadi, now you should kiss his feet. And now that he laid out the law with a red line and is attacking this government, they've been calling me from the media saying, what made Biden do such a about turn? And I have to keep saying it was not an about turn. It's an exacerbation of what he did from the beginning. So my dumbest take on news is from Yair Lapid, and it's actually funny. I think it's funny because Yair Lapid has this way of connecting things rhetorically, which sound like an argument, but are not an argument at all. And a lot of people have been making fun of him. I had one wise crack that became sort of viral when I said that his mind is like a market of fake brands in Thailand. Everything's shiny, nothing means anything, and he has all these rolling phrases. So he sat at INSS, where else? Someone quipped on Israeli media that behind every really stupid statement in Israel is the logo of the INSS. So
I have to say, there have been, since October 7th, I hate to be too critical of these people, because I know a lot of them and like a lot of them and so on, but they do have some stock taking to do, for sure.
So Yair Lapid sat there for an interview, and he said, you know, people say that the lesson from October 7 is that we shouldn't have a Palestinian state, but we didn't have a Palestinian state on the 7th of October. So I don't understand the linkage. He said linkage. He actually said linkage in Hebrew.
And I saw that. Linkage. I saw that. I forgot. I should have brought it as my mistake.
People just shake their heads at the Yair Lapid. And
I also, you know, I don't, I feel, I don't know why, I feel a little bit discomfort criticizing somebody like Yair Lapid or making fun of him. But there is something about the guy, like the Yinon Magal's, Yinon Magal's daily
and nightly, it's called the Lapid and his
opposite.
So, Lapid
Vipuchol. I think we probably talked about it here, but just in case we haven't, there's a guy on, he's a right wing figure, the left hates him. He's got a funny Twitter feed where he puts quotes together of Lapid saying directly contradictory things, sometimes in the same sentence. Sometimes he'll take something from 6 months ago and today and show that he's saying the exact opposite, sometimes in the same sentence. And once you know the game, it's so fun.
It is. And just to give you a taste of what we mean by hipucho, but by the complete contradiction, is it, there was one of the famous one is a quote of Yair Lapid saying, the minister of the treasury should be an economist. And then there's a quote saying, the minister of the treasury shouldn't be an economist. And you just put them together. And because this is, and my take on this, Mike, is that this is pure postmodernism. There is no truth. There are only interests. And so Lapid is not lying. He's on the level, because since there is no truth, there's also no lies. There is just being attuned to what the needs of the moment are. The problem is, it doesn't work very well.
It reminds me of John Kerry, who I call the Ted Baxter of American diplomacy. Ted Baxter, you have to be my age and an American to remember who he was, but he was on the Mary Tyler Moore show. He was the news reader, because he had a deep voice and he sounded like a serious person, but in his head was mush.
Yeah, Lapid was a TV personality and a journalist.
He looks the part. He looks like a serious guy, but when you listen to what he's saying, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and he was prime minister here. That's incredible. And also, he's considered a lackey like Gantz, but even more so of the American administration. And as you know, and we can remind our listeners and viewers, that he signed the 4 days before an election, which is usually a time when you don't make changes, he signed the maritime border deal vis-a-vis Lebanon and gave basically the deal that gave Hezbollah everything and Israel almost nothing. And then he did not put it up for the approval of the Knesset. He signed it in the name of the State of Israel, basically unconstitutionally, and in accord with what the wishes of the White House were, not the Israeli electorate. And then there's a clip of him being recorded. I think he would get a tickle from being called prime minister. So a woman, anonymous woman behind the camera, young woman by her voice, saying, "Prime Minister, what did Israel get from the maritime border deal?" And he said, "One, security; two, and I don't remember. And then he said, this is on a way to being a peace deal with another Arab country or something like this. And, you know, you look at this after in your news bulletin, 1,000 rockets were shot by Hezbollah at Israel this morning. That's the security.
I remember that clip. One of the things was prosperity as well.
Prosperity. We got prosperity.
Yeah.
Yeah. So prosperous as we are, we will plow on. Thank you very much for being in with us for the Israel Update Hour, and see you next Tuesday in our next amazing episode.